From WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM, this is Unnecessary and Proper, a show about
politics,
culture,
and the other thing.
Hello and welcome to Unnecessary and Proper, the show where four flagrantly unqualified friends gather to discuss politics, culture, and the other things. My name is Kyle Henson. I am joined today by Nick Perlosky.
Hey, listeners.
Connor Boyle.
Hello, friends.
And the diplomat himself, Mr. Rohan Gulati.
Good evening, colleagues.
Round the horn, real quick, to start us off. Boyle, who wrote the op-ed?
I am going to stick with my initial read of Mike Pence, but I think that as the perception among especially centrists has waned in the last few weeks, I think it's more and more likely we're going to have a delayed reveal of who it's going to be. It will, of course, eventually come to the fore at some point, but I think it's going to be way more delayed. Whereas before, I think that when Trump comes crashing down, they were going to point to it and be like, look, I was advocating for the Republic. And now they're like, oh, wow, that's not going to work as a strategy anymore. So,
Interesting. Nick?
I will go with, first, can I just say, Rohan, I think your greeting of good evening is flagrantly biased against any potential morning or afternoon listeners. This is a key demo we're trying to get. Let's not do what we can to turn them off.
But good day.
There we go. But I think my initial guess was Nikki Haley. I think it's somebody who is in this administration and not necessarily of this administration. I think it's somebody who really tries to stand up for conservatism, and I think it's somebody that has aspirations in the future. And for me, those three things are all her.
Interesting. And Rohan?
I have a few guesses. I'd say my wild card guess is Kellyanne.
That is such a wild card guess.
I only say that because Kellyanne is the definition of a mercenary. I don't think she has any actual political beliefs, and so I think this is like a way for her to clear her conscience, perhaps.
But the op-ed touts conservative victories.
Sure, and I think I should say this. I don't think Kellyanne is dedicated to is actually a Trumper or a Trumpist, whatever the word is. I think
it's a trumpeter.
It's trumpeter, actually, according to Sarah Palin. So Kellyanne's the wild card guess, and I think John Kelly is the actual guest. I think it's a military guy who's a conservative.
Ooh, I like the military angle. That makes sense to me.
Kyle?
I think it's not someone who has aspirations like beyond this presidency, and I actually think it's just someone who is trying to generate some administrative buy-in. And so I think it's Jeff Sessions because he knows that he's on the ouster after this Russia stuff concludes anyway. He knows that Trump hates him and, like, love him or hate him, maybe mostly hate him. He does actually, like, stand for something and have beliefs, and he does sort of believe in, like, this aspirational idea of the Republic to a degree. And so I think it strikes me that he would write that. But my wild card guess is that it's Ivanka. And that she, like, is secretly planning a, like, House of Cards-style coup against Trump, and this is how it starts. So, anyway, if you couldn't have guessed, we're talking about President Trump today. Going to talk about short-term with this op-ed and the Bob Woodward book coming out, kind of medium-term prospects for when the Russia investigation wraps up and what the election and how a post-midterms Trump will take the Republic, and kind of long-term, life after the Trump presidency, when he, you know, finally is out of office after, you know, two victories in 2024, or, you know, next week as new allegations surface and he gets unanimously impeached.
Any TBD. Moment, truly.
Any moment. So we're going to start off with the short-term. We got the op-ed, we got the Bob Woodward book. Boyle, give us your take.
So, I mean, the news cycle, as is custom in the Trump era, is unrelenting. And if you're like me, you probably turned off your news alerts at some point because it became too much to deal with. But I did manage to follow the news enough to learn about the Bob Woodward book. And also, obviously, this op-ed is all over the place. I think that the Bob Woodward book is very, I mean, obviously different than, the last kind of expose, the Michael Wolff kind of fabricated, like, memoirist, all of these leeway, like, these kind of freedom, poetic, artistic freedoms he takes in kind of remembering things that happened in the administration. I think Bob Woodward is a more not like completely unimpeachable journalist, but more definitely respected in by like most people. So I think that
he's more of a journalist.
Yeah, he's more of a journalist in the first place. But like a lot of people came to his defense when the book came out and were like, Bob Woodward's reporting is meticulous and you should pretty much take everything that's in the book as accurately transcribed from whoever dictated it to him. So it's like if the source giving it to him wasn't being truthful and he had no way of corroborating or kind of like disproving it, then like it is as it was told. So like I can't imagine that the book is a completely faithful like rendition of the facts, but I do think it matches up with my, I think, most expectations of what actually goes on in the White House. The thing that was, I guess, surprising, and I think that a lot of people on the right and the left agreed about, which is my kind of biggest takeaway, is that people working against Trump, or rather people working for Trump to kind of keep his worst interests and worst inclinations in check. Inclinations, thank you. His worst inclinations in check are truly anti-democratic and like working kind of in their best interest, certainly, and maybe in the country's best interest in their mind, but they're unelected. And I think Obama's point in his recent speech kind of summed it up is that like this is not good for democracy as a whole if you have these people kind of in the Oval Office swiping papers off the desk.
The so-called steady state.
Ugh, amazing wordplay. Terrible actual government.
Yeah, that's someone who had a... I think we should be looking at people who, you know, took economics classes.
Larry Kudlow. That's my wild card candidate, actually, because he's also known to have used Lodestar, and I assume I'm pronouncing that correctly, in previous, I guess, like correspondence or speeches, but Larry Kudlow is the wild card pick. But yeah, continue.
Right. The sleuthing, the nitpicking of each and every individual word that's going to go on and continue to go on with this, I feel like is just amazing. Rohan, I didn't mean to step on your toes there, but I do think that like we in the group, we kind of had a differing of opinions on this, because for me, this is kind of like dividing by negative one. Like I view this as this is a bad administration and individuals doing bad within that for the good of the country. Like, I'm happy that there are adults in the room that take papers off of his desk. I'm happy that there are people who withhold certain information. I'm happy that there are individuals who are able to take meetings with the president and instead of saying he said X, is to come back and say that he said Y. I think that that makes the country better off for it.
Ugh.
And damn the constitutional crisis.
I could not disagree more. I think it's what's so interesting is if you look at the actual wording of the 25th Amendment, it actually says that when the cabinet secretaries and the vice president decide that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties. And I find the inclusion of the word duties in there as like, I don't know, I feel like it's so prescient of whoever actually wrote, I don't even know who wrote the amendment, but whoever actually wrote the amendment.
It was
because
drafted
it's like,
in the wake of Kennedy's assassination, so presumably it was, you know, a bunch of legislators.
Sure, but I mean, whoever put duties in there, it's such like an interesting word to include, because the idea of the duties of the office, the duties of the office of presidency, is something that even I've talked to Trump supporters who don't think that he's really living up to like what it means to be president, just in terms of decorum, in terms of like, you know, word choice and like, you know, general
being
obligations.
Yeah.
If you could get impeached for not following the take care clause, which is probably one of the most important clause of the Constitution, which says that the president will have the obligation to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. Frankly, Trump could probably be impeached on those grounds.
And frankly, Obama could have as well.
That's a classic Kyle play right there.
I'm sure W could have too. But anyway,
actually, can we talk about it? Can we talk about impeachment for a quick second?
Sure.
Yeah.
Short term, right?
Oh, well, actually, let me just wrap up real quick. So on the topic of the op-ed, on the topic of the cabinet secretaries, I agree with many that, you know, you either invoke the 25th, you faithfully carry out the orders of the president in the capacity that they're formal orders, and or you resign and speak out if you are unwilling to do what the president says. If you are an unelected official, those are your three options. Rohan, please continue.
Yeah, I mean, I think that frankly, we could have an entire discussion about this, but since we're not doing that, let me move on and say, I think that the recent scandals, most specifically You know, I think this memo is part is one of the sort of this op-ed is part of that part of the sort of recent scandals, the Bob Woodward book, and the Paul Manafort trials and the Michael Cohen guilty plea. I think those this sort of slew of scandals has put the sort of the I word of impeachment on the table. You're no longer sort of like a loon to be considering or talking about impeachment. You know, I remember there was, I forget his name now, but there was a Democrat, sort of congressman who started, who wanted to submit the articles of impeachment, and everyone sort of rightfully so, I think, looked at him as kind of being crazy.
Mm-hmm. And
now
well.
It's not so crazy. You know, I think that, you know, I personally think that it, as we learn more about Trump specifically directing Michael Cohen to, commit a campaign finance violation for the purpose of misleading the American public about his affair with Stormy Daniels and Karen, or sort of Stephanie Clifford and Karen McDougal, in order to sort of affect the election. To me, that still is the biggest, one of the biggest moments, or biggest scandals of this presidency, almost more so than the Russia investigation, although stay tuned on that, obviously.
Yeah, I'd say Russia so far.
Yes,
Russia definitely has
agreed.
More potential.
From what we know, I think that, you know, Trump's liability, he very much, I think, very much appears to be an unindicted co-conspirator in the Michael Cohen case. And so I think it's really interesting. I don't know what you guys think about this sort of this sea change that we're seeing, where people are we're sort of talking about the word impeachment is no longer gives sort of creates or, you know, has people giving you funny look.
Yeah, well, I think it's super interesting given the timing of this op-ed and the Bob Woodward book, which almost makes you think that they were done in concert and that whoever wrote the op-ed was probably a hefty source for the Woodward book. But what I would say is I think the timing is really interesting because it's right around also the time that people are starting to make up their minds regarding midterms.
Yeah.
And the sort of inherent tribalism that comes with, if you are really getting behind a Democratic senator or something, you're going to be exposed to more people and more ideas that will probably make you, if you are on moderate or on the fence, will probably just make you less inclined to have a favorable view of President Trump. And these two really damning works to come out right around this time, I think, probably is sort of icing on the cake of that trend. So
and Kyle,
kind of borne out.
I don't want to step on your toes. I thought you were going to say this just now. What you're mentioning, this trend here, is exactly borne out by the data, by the polls.
Exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah, yeah. Go for
that's,
it.
Yeah. So I mean, President Trump's own approval rating has gone down by somewhere between 6 and 10 points, depending on the poll. And then you can also take a look at Democrats asserting their lead in the generic ballot polling to, I think, 8 or 9 points in the most recent Real Clear Politics polling average, up from as low as 4, but recently having stabilized around 6. And so that's a pretty significant movement. And I think, you know, these coming out right around this time is pretty key in order for Democrats to potentially retake at least the House in 2018, which kind of brings us pretty neatly to our next topic, which is kind of Trump's medium term. So after the election of 2018, you know, we might get some more from the Russia investigation. We kind of assume it's probably going to go quiet for the next 2 months so as not to interfere with the election.
Though I should note that Paul Manafort's second trial, I believe, is scheduled for September 17th.
Sure. That is out of Mueller's hands,
yes,
though, or Mueller's hands.
So I mean, that will be in the news, and it's depending on whether, you know, he decides to go forward with a trial, which I think is very ill-advised. But anyway,
there was a consensus among the Slack today that it's unlikely we're going to see the big, I don't know, star-esque report, the Mueller report, come down between now and the midterm.
I'm not even sure there's going to be a Mueller report, frankly.
I think he speaks
in indictments. I think that's how he's communicating with the public.
And so the Star, I guess, at the time the Star report was published, there were DOJ guidelines that, I guess, recommended or required the writing of a report that have since expired, and the replacement guidelines don't require that. So that's kind of, I think, a thing. It was an op-ed or an article I was reading today about Mueller's adherence to the book, and that's kind of, I think, he's never going to deviate from the company line if the company is the DOJ. So I think that's kind of, what was that sound? Is that Nick's dog?
Yeah.
Oh, the fifth member, R.I.P. Mike. So just on the note of the medium term, I think the question that is most interesting to me for the midterms and also kind of for Trump's long and medium term support is 63 million Americans cast a vote for Donald Trump and Mike Pence in 2016 in the election. That's an astronomical number, right? That's a huge portion of the voting population. And I want the question for me is, how many of those did so pretty reluctantly? They're like, I feel anxiety about a number of things, or maybe I feel, I guess, extreme fervent nationalism, or I feel a whole number of emotions pulling me in a direction. But how many cast a vote for Donald Trump and were like, I don't feel totally great about this? Because I think that those who voted for Trump and felt great about it and are advocating for him still and are kind of the bedrock of his base, they're not going anywhere. It's not worth really talking about
them. The so-called sort of 30%, that floor that really even Nixon didn't lose even during the worst parts of Watergate.
So that's my first question. Is the floor 30% in terms of Trump's support of the voting population? Is that what we think it is?
I think the general consensus among sort of the polling experts is like high 20s into 30s is like,
which is a lot.
And the floor. You're generally yeah. you can even if you as the saying goes, shot a man on Fifth Avenue, you might not lose those individuals.
That's not a saying. That's not a saying that goes, I'm rejecting the entry of shooting a man on Fifth Avenue into the lexicon.
It's too late. It's too late, Kyle.
It was such a good point by Trump, though. It was like, he said it, and I was like, wow, that was excellent commentary. I was like, like, because it was. It's like wow, like, he could get away with that. Like, you sit there thinking about it. But I don't know. I think the question for me is, how many people that voted for him are like, you know, this is actually bearing out as kind of what my worst fear was going to be, and that he's going to be not a role model. He's going to be doing things that, I think the scandal A1 is got to be child separation, I think, if like in hindsight, but I'll flip it to Kyle now.
So, I wanted to flip it to Nick, who can probably cast a decent light on this as a resident conservative Republican in the podcast, who is disheartened with Trump. I mean, the question you're asking is, how many Nicks are there?
Well, in this, as in all things, there are far too few Nicks. I think that I honestly would put him... thanks for giving me the laugh there. I was worried you're taking me seriously. I honestly would put it slightly higher.
The floor,
pollsters,
you mean?
Pundits, whatever. Yeah, exactly. If the consensus is high 20s or low 30s, I would be surprised if it gets below the mid 30s. I think that Trump's approval rating among Republicans was like 90% or something like that. And I think
at least, yeah,
he's not going to get to Nixonian levels because I don't think we were as polarized then. I think in 1974,
I agree,
there were so many more Republicans who were willing to say, this dude is crazy. Like, what are we doing in bed with this guy? Versus now, Trump could go out one day and say thing X, and then go out the next day and say thing X is the exact opposite of what the truth is, and people would believe him both times. From 1 week to the next. And so I think that there is a large swath of his voters of those 63 million people who, yes, Connor, I think to your point, there's a number of them who said, like, well, you know, I'm kind of going to bite my tongue while doing it, but we got to get good Supreme Court justices, or we got to get good tax relief, or repeal Obamacare, or whatever. All these great things that Republicans wanted to do, and you can't do any of them with a Democrat in the Oval Office, and there's just going to be enough people who just keep swallowing their tongue and doing exactly that.
Yeah, and I was going to say, to your point about the hyper-partisanship, exactly, I, as a former Republican, and like have definitely disavowed completely the Republican Party of today.
We'll win you back.
We'll see. Hopefully. I would love for the Republican Party to come in line with my ideals. But what I think is that, the idea of like voting for a Democrat or supporting Democrats is just reflexively emotionally awful. And I've like been really trying to rehardwire myself, but it's just a complete non-starter. And so like, yeah, just really, really tough. Even though I like really I understand the toxicity of our polarization, I decry it, I hate it, I wish it wasn't so. Like, the idea of personally supporting a Democrat is just like an unbelievably awful, unspeakable evil.
Well, and
like
Kyle's like setting his phone background as Cory Booker just to like get himself used to it, like day after day. Like, it's like a little bit, just a taste, and he's like, oh god, I'm not used to it yet.
It's not that bad. I will say, though, that the Democratic Party has not been immune to this as well. They have but been pushed further and further to the left in very recent memory, and they're, frankly, just as bad as we are in terms of escalating partisanship and the number of self-avowed socialists who are about to win seats in Congress. Like, it's not just Republicans that are going off the deep end here.
That's true. That's very true. I mean, I agree, and I think the Republicans are sort of... the Democrats are sort of suffering from the same issue the Republicans did in 2008, 9, and 10, which is that they're campaigning against what's happening and not for something in sort of a way that is maybe like a dominant message from them. Rohan, I'll let you continue.
Well, I do think that I'm not quite convinced that the Democrats are totally campaigning against the Republicans. I think you're right that Trump's a driving factor in these races, but I do want to go back to the topic at hand, which is sort of the Trump in the medium term. And I think what's really going to be interesting to see is in these midterms, I think, you know, there's a reasonably high percent chance that the Democrats take the House. And if they do, they're going to become in charge of any number of committees, judiciary, oversight, commerce. I mean, there's all sorts of committees that...
Ways and means,
appropriations. I mean, there's all sorts of committees out there that I'm just going to keep naming committees.
Kyle's got the Wikipedia list.
They have
up.
Subpoena power. Agriculture. Lord knows what they can do with the agriculture committee.
Wheat, raisin.
There's all sorts of committees that Democrats will sort of be in charge of and will be able to wield as a cudgel against this administration. I think there's a lot of sort of scandals that we kind of there was a memo that Republicans were floating, sort of worrying about all these scandals that the Democrats are going to investigate. It was sort of this very hilarious, sad kind of reflection of the Republican Party in which they were complaining about all these sort of or complaining that the Democrats are going to be able to investigate all this corruption that like clearly exists if they get in charge as opposed to doing their own job and being a check on Trump and acting like a sort of co-equal branch of government. Anyway, I think that's going to be really interesting because I think congressional Democrats will wield that power with some level of effectiveness. I'm not sure they'll be as effective as say, who's the congressman who's retiring? Trey Gowdy. Sort of Trey Gowdy during Benghazi. But I think that they're going to be able to really shine a light on some really bad behavior that's been swept out under the rug. And the other thing is, I think Trump's ability to sort of govern is going very much like Obama in his first term. Is going to evaporate more so than it already has. I mean, what legislation, assuming the Democrats take the House, is he going to sign? None.
Well, okay, I mean,
he's going to be a lame duck president for the last 2 years.
I'll take the other side of that.
Get the House.
Because what was it part of the tax bill that he just kind of snuck a curveball in there with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, and like Paul Ryan walked out of the meeting and was just like, I don't know what the hell just happened, and had said so publicly. Like I think. If and likely when the Democrats take the House back, I think Donald Trump he gets on his populism high horse and he says, all right, like I worked with these guys when I was in New York and building buildings and whatever, and I'm going to keep on keeping on.
I could totally see that, optimistic. Actually. Also, because the thing is, like, I think we're seeing a lot more party ideology alignment, realignment, right now and in the past, like maybe 2 years and probably in the next two, we'll see a decent amount. And that's creating like weird areas of overlap, like tough on crime, traditionally Republican, but all of a sudden sexual assault becomes a hugely important issue for the Democratic Party's base. And so now they're really tough on crime. And so like things like that, you see weird areas of overlap, like tariffs and protectionism of blue collar workers, like traditional Democratic.
That's the big one in my mind.
Yeah, that, like,
I feel like
now Trump has like really like cast a gigantic stake in the ground that completely turned the Rust Belt. I mean, like, I think that there is weird overlap that to Nick's point, that could surface and actually create a bizarrely productive second 2 years. And maybe even ironically more productive, which would be hilarious.
I know. The thing is that I think the percentage chance of that happening is just it gets smaller as time has gone on and Trump has kind of retreated into the tribe. I think that early on in his presidency, you saw a lot more of like, oh, like people like it when I kind of work with the other side a little bit, and kind of was leaning into that a bit, especially I think in the middle to the end of his first year when kind of like Steve Bannon's urges had been kind of tamped down a little bit. And it was kind of like, we're just kind of getting settled into what the administrative, like, kind of policy outlook is going to be. And I think that that was when the some of the kind of Pelosi-Schumer meetings were happening, and Trump was kind of playing both sides. But in the last, I don't know, if you look at his rhetoric, I think that Trump is definitely, it changes with the wind, but I think that the rhetoric has me convinced that he is kind of, he sees himself as fighting against the Democratic Party, like, as a whole. I don't think that it's going to be as soon as all of a sudden they're in power and they're investigating his family
for
corruption. Assuming if they take the House, all of a sudden all these investigations are cropping up. I don't think Trump is going to think olive branch necessarily. Yeah. But just a recap, for the first two parts of our episode, we've got short term, not so great. Medium term, similarly not great.
And before we move into the long term, I just want to have one around the horn question. What do you guys think the outcome of the Russia investigation will be? Boyle?
I'll start. Yeah. Trump knew about the Russia meeting. I think it is known already, maybe. But I think there's going to be very clear-cut, Mueller's going to have very clear-cut evidence that there was an effort from the Trump campaign to solicit assistance from Russia. That is, I don't know how it's going to be found. I don't know what makes it illegal, but I think there's going to be some smoking gun of sorts that is like they colluded. I think that's going to be what the kind of the takeaway is. I just have no idea how that resolves, because like colluded with a foreign power, like that's the thing. So I think it's going to be.
I just don't know what it looks like.
There's too much smoke, and I think Trump's team is too incompetent at being evil for there not to be fire, but I don't know what the fire is going to result in. That's my take.
All right, Nick?
I agree with that partially. I think that there's a ton of smoke, and there's definitely enough of a collusatory, if that is a word, happening.
It is now.
Collusive.
Yeah, right. Collusive. There's our addition to the lexicon for the day. That's the UNP contribution.
Hallucinogenic.
Hey man, come to Oregon. That's, we got all kind of hallucinogenic drugs out here.
Ooh.
But I don't think that that's the hill that they die on. I think that they're not going to go down for collusion. If they're going down for anything, it's going to be obstruction of justice.
Rohan.
I totally actually forgot about obstruction of justice. I think you're right, Nick. I think obstruction of justice is the main sort of the brunt of it. My concern is that basically this is how I sort of ascribe a high likelihood to the following events. I think we will find out the Trump campaign knew that the WikiLeaks stuff was coming from Russia. I think they're going to know to a certain extent when sort of the timing of things were. I don't think there was ever a handshake agreement. I think that's not what's going to happen, and the bar has been set that's what people are expecting, and that's why everyone's going to be very disappointed. I agree with that completely. I think it's enough to say, like, I think the sort of not the winking and nodding is enough to sort of count as collusion, but the public will not think so. And I think what's going to happen is it's going to be kind of like the Tom Brady generally aware thing, and the Trump campaign's been like, yeah, so what? We knew about it. Like, so what? And people are going to be like, yeah, well, I guess I didn't like tell them to do it, so I guess it's not that big of a deal. And then with the obstruction stuff, he's going to be like, well, it wasn't even a crime. What crime? How could I obstruct justice if there's no crime? I was just trying to get it.
They just call it fighting back.
Fighting back. I mean, the groundwork's already been laid. So that's what I sort of ascribe a high likelihood to. I think that the nation will go through a very protracted, painful period of bitter partisan divide if that happens.
Like now?
It'll be worse.
Better, it'll I don't bitterer. Know what you're talking about.
I think, yes, it'll be bitterer and precisely. Nick's just
bitterer and partisaner.
Amazing.
Kyle, what's your 30,000 foot take?
Well, yeah. So I actually really buy Rohan's assessment. I think what happened was that Trump leaned into what he or his campaign or someone knew to be probably shady Russian intelligence gathering operations on the Hillary Clinton campaign. Like, I think that the degree to which Trump leaned into it is up for debate a little bit. But I think, you know, Trump definitely leaned into it, whether it's, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, whether it's like, hey, we want to take this meeting. And then, you know, who knew about the meeting kind of deal. Maybe we'll send this person, maybe not that person. Or like, you know, someone on the campaign was really trying to make themselves stand out in the campaign and like on an unauthorized capacity, like potentially like solicited things, but it wasn't really authorized by anyone else in the campaign. Like some, I don't know, someone leaned into it to a degree. I think the Democrats do bring articles of impeachment, but I think he doesn't get impeached by the Senate.
Convicted by the Senate. Got it.
Or yeah, convicted by the Senate. I'm sorry. Yeah. So anyway, with that, in our final few minutes, let's take it to the long term. Post Donald Trump presidency.
There is no post Donald Trump presidency. A meteor wipes out all life on Earth, all human life on Earth.
Oh, all right. If only we could be so lucky, Rohan.
We all know Rohan is Team Meteor.
We're all Team Meteor. Yeah, that's a podcast wide belief at this point.
We could do the Veep stakes for Team Meteor.
I've got an analogy for our one listener. Is you remember when John McCain died a few weeks ago, and everyone was like, "Oh, look at George Bush passing candy to Michelle Obama. How precious!" And for the briefest, the fleetingest of moments, George Bush was like remembered as like a pretty all right guy. And I think that as time has gone on, and also as Trump has been compared as like, "Oh, how was our last Republican president?" Like the lens through which we look at George Bush W rather changes. I think that his legacy kind of gets a boost, which is crazy considering he has embroiled us in the greatest geopolitical disaster of the 21st century, that is the Iraq War. And I just, the fact
hard
that
disagree
like
on that.
His, oh God, the fact that his,
well,
that's a different
a podcast
episode
worth having.
But so I just feel like the fact that George Bush's stock can shift even a little bit in so few number of years tells me that anything's possible. Trump's election told me that anything was possible.
Bush's
but I just don't think that
because Trump got elected, though, right? Because there was someone worse,
right?
So the worrying thing—that's
a good point.
Obama's
so,
stock has changed after the fact. Like HW's stock changed after the fact.
Everyone's stock changes after the fact, but I think
so.
Bill Clinton,
I'll clarify.
I mean,
I'll get
love
to my
Bill
thesis.
Clinton
my thesis
of the country somehow, even though he probably committed rape and like was definitely impeached.
So the so much to unpack. The thing, my thesis, my condensed thesis is it's going to be so easy to retake up a politics of hope at some point in the future. Maybe it's 50 years. I have no idea. That it's going to be eventually like maybe in the shorter long term, like say like 2024, 2026. It's going to be easy to be like, wow, that was terrible, and just put it in the rearview mirror conclusively. I think that Trump's legacy cannot improve. Like, there's nothing Trump can do in the remainder of his term unless he makes a complete, I don't know. I can't imagine his legacy, him doing anything to improve it moving forward. I think it's set in stone. It's going to be, he's going to be reviewed as
well.
One of the worst.
He donates his entire net worth to Planned Parenthood.
So what, like $300 and a bunch of Russian debt? like
Oh, all right, Nick, what's your long term?
Does Planned Parenthood want that, to be
honest?
Trump
presidency.
So, long term, and I say this is a personal fault of mine, I always view things as probably more optimistic than I should. And I you guys see me, I've got a nice glass of scotch here that I've been drinking throughout the podcast. We stopped at a duty free shop on Friday morning as the plane was boarding. I told my buddy, I was like, no, let's just go back and we'll have time. We got there 45 seconds before they closed the door. But in my, like, for me, that's how I view the world. Things always work out. And I think that that's going to be the case with the Republican Party. I think that Donald Trump is viewed as a, you know, this is if the Republican Party if it's a marriage, Donald Trump is viewed as the 26-year-old, you know, attractive, skinny blonde girl that led the husband to have a midlife crisis. And it caused a huge rift between the husband and the wife. But after 6 months, they're able to work their differences out and remember why they loved each other in the first place and fall back in love. And Donald Trump, Connor, I agree with you. Donald Trump is always viewed as this singularly terrible, awful blip, this name that shall not be mentioned, and the Republican Party right ship.
I disagree with that assessment.
Same.
I think that we're actually going to undergo demographic shift and realignment in terms of coalitions. And I think a lot of Trump's ideas are here to stay. And I think we're actually going to head into like a 20 plus year period, like a generation's worth of time where both parties are big government parties. I don't think the Republican Party is going to actually return to a limited government thing. I guess I don't see.
So when are you moving is the real question then, Kyle?
To where?
To your
where is
your
the
island
government
of Wi-Fi.
Smaller?
Your island with Wi-Fi.
Oh, fair. Anyway. Whenever I can construct it. But no, realistically, I really feel like, you know, we are heading into a politics that's dominated by two coalitions. We have this sort of progressive left, which is just an inherently socialist leaning big government like group. And then we have
Evil Empire,
this sort of like working class, blue collar,
heroic,
like Rust Belt. I guess I didn't hear what you said, but
subject of Bruce Springsteen albums.
Yeah, subject of Bruce Springsteen albums.
Good
exactly.
God, Boyle.
And they want the government to step in and like kind of ease their decline and protect their culture. So I think we sort of have, you know, two dominant factions of American politics.
Protect their culture. Now there's a dog whistle if I haven't heard one.
Well, I'm saying that that's what I think they want to do.
No, I know.
I think it sort of is in some ways a dog whistle. Actually, I'm not disagreeing.
Kyle, you're writing a script to
I'm
a Bravo movie
it,
right now. This is ridiculous. Rohan, please take over.
No, I think.
Anyway.
We're sort of on the topic of sort of like what comes after Trump. I think Nick sort of talking about the Republican Party. I think it's going to be interesting to see whether, if you look at the underlying sort of issue that propelled Trump to victory, it was immigration. That's what the first speech was about, and I think that's what really rallied people to him. And so it remains to be seen. I think it's very difficult to predict trends in politics by and large. I'm not going to pretend to do so, but if that does persist, that will be, I think, his lasting legacy is the kind of radicalization of our immigration politics and our immigration policies. And so my concern is the sort of increasing sort of the Republican Party remaining and becoming more so the party of sort of racial resentment, in a way that leads to more people like Trump having an influence in the Republican Party. Or whether it is just a blip. I don't think it's just a blip. I think the ideas of Trump, whether it's sort of this economic populism, very protectionist kind of policies, or this very hardline immigration restrictionism, I think those are here to stay. And my concern is mainly the immigration restrictionism, not so much of people who want to restrict immigration, but sort of the people who are motivated by very sort of pernicious reasons for restricting immigration.
I do think that, I think, Rohan, there's definitely a lot to that. I do think that in 2020, I think it's very likely that a Democratic president will win. And then I think the Republican Party is going to have to do a lot of soul searching, because they will have only won the popular vote in one presidential election since 1988.
I disagree with it being highly likely that a Democrat wins in 2020. I think the chance that
you think Trump gets reelected?
I think the chance that Trump gets reelected is higher than the chance that he got elected in the first place. I think he starts out at better than 50%.
I agree.
Yeah, I mean,
I think it's higher than that he got elected. I think it's not higher than 50%.
I mean, here's my scenario. The Democrats are now, it's the party of the left, and it's an Elizabeth Warren or a Kamala Harris or a Cory Booker or even actual Bernie Sanders himself. It's a harder left. It's not a Joe Biden anymore. It's a hard left person who gets elected, and some of those middle ground people from the Wisconsins and Michigans and Pennsylvanias of the world say, "What the I don't like this Trump guy, but I'm not going to vote for Cory Booker. I'm not going to vote for Elizabeth Warren." And they stick with their guns and they stick with Trump, or they just like last time, they just don't show up on election day. And Trump squeaks by with an even lower vote total.
Well, that's one way to do it. TBD, what actually happens. We've got a little over 2 years for that. But anyway, this has been Unnecessary.
Cue this episode up and listen to the recording. Sorry, Kyle. Go ahead.
All right. This has been Unnecessary and Proper. You can find us online at unnecessaryandproper.com. Shoot us an email, unnecessaryandproper@gmail.com. President Trump, we're still waiting for your submission after our Puerto Rico episode. But you can also find us on iTunes. We're working on Google Play, and hopefully we'll be there shortly. And yeah, have a wonderful evening.